Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Australian Human Rights Commission. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Catherine Branson, and I became President of the Australian Human Rights Commission in the middle of October of last year, and I'm delighted to see you all here. Could I begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respect to their elders past and present. I'm delighted to be able to chair this seminar this evening because we're particularly privileged to have with us His Honour Michael McHugh, ACQC, as he now is. I think nearly everyone here will know that Mr McHugh was a Justice of the High Court of Australia, and he held that position from 1989 to 2005. Prior to holding that high office in our country, he was a judge of the New South Wales Court of Appeal. Following his retirement from the High Court, Mr McHugh became one of the non-permanent justices of the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong. During his 16 years on the bench, Justice McHugh handed down probably hundreds of judgments which have been influential in the development of Australian jurisprudence across a wide range of areas. The area of the law of tort, as well as constitutional law, come immediately to mind. Though he professed to an audience at Sydney University, I am told, to have social views as radical as anyone in the room, that, I think, was not ultimately His Honour's reputation as a judge of the High Court of Australia. There are decisions, as you know, where His Honour took a view which have not appealed to the more radical of those in the Australian community, but no one, I think, has not said of His Honour's judgment that they were principled, constrained, and followed all of the best traditions of the common law, development of the law. His Honour has been a strong proponent for equality. He has pushed about the need for greater gender equality on the High Court, and I'm sure he, along with those of us at the Human Rights Commission, and I hope many in this room, will be pleased now to see that we have three women on the High Court of Australia. His Honour has also called for much better human rights protection for Australia. Let's hope that that which he's advocated in that regard is as similarly rewarded as his advocacy for more women in senior judicial office, including on the High Court. It's timely, of course, to be considering issues of the Human Rights Act and the implications of the Australian Constitution so far as the protection of human rights is concerned, because we have a national consultation on human rights well underway as we meet here tonight. All of you, I think, will be aware of the national consultation being conducted by the Committee of Four, chaired by Father Frank Brennan. Here at the Commission, we support and we will be advocating for a Human Rights Act for Australia, a statutory model of human rights protection, which we believe will improve Australia's culture so far as human rights awareness is concerned and the consideration of human rights at all aspects of government decision-making, and also because we feel it will assist Australian courts through an interpretive provision be more sensitive where Parliament allows them to be to the human rights of the Australian people. As I understand it, it may be that Mr McHugh will advocate for a stronger model than we've been advocating. I'm not sure. We feel somewhat constrained by the limitation placed on the consultative committee, but there are, of course, various models of a Human Rights Act, and I, for one, look forward with great anticipation to the model, if any, that Mr McHugh will advocate tonight. Before handing over to Mr McHugh, could I just raise a few practical matters? You will have noticed that today's seminar is being filmed and a video recording will be available on our website. The room has a hearing loop in operation for anyone who wishes to use it. If at the end of the presentation by Mr McHugh you would wish to ask a question or make a comment, there will be a handheld microphone available for you. The women's toilet is outside this door and across the hall. The men's is back past the lifts and down the corridor on the left. Finally, when we've finished the work of the day, there'll be light refreshments available, and I invite you all to stay and join us for those. Please join me now in welcoming the Honourable Michael McHugh, ACQC.
Thank you, President. As you are aware, the title of this presentation is the Human Rights Act, the Courts and the Constitution, and the title itself indicates that the matters about which I will be talking are necessarily technical to some extent, indeed to a large extent, but so far as I've been able to, I have tried to keep them within bounds and to eschew technical discussion as much as I can, but the nature of the subject means that there will be a discussion, considerable discussion, about some legal propositions. Now, the terms of reference of the National Human Rights Consultation Committee make it clear that for the foreseeable future, there is no prospect of the Parliament of the Commonwealth introducing legislation for the purpose of amending the Constitution to insert a Bill of Rights. It seems inevitable, therefore, that any protection of human rights at the federal level will be the product of legislation passed by the Parliament and not a constitutional amendment. The rationale for legislative as opposed to a constitutional Bill of Rights is that it maintains parliamentary sovereignty. Given that a constitutional Bill of Rights is not presently feasible, the issue is what form of federal legislation will best serve the cause of promoting human rights against the inroads of federal legislation while at the same time preserving parliamentary sovereignty. The two legislatures which have introduced human rights legislation in Australia, the Australian Capital Territory and the State of Victoria, have both agreed to the so-called dialogue model, which involves the courts drawing the attention of the legislature to legislation which impermissibly affects human rights and provoking a response from the legislature. The dialogue focuses on the consistency of laws with the rights included in the human rights interests, human rights instrument. It requires courts to interpret legislation so far as is reasonably possible with the object of preserving the rights referred to in the legislation. But where it's not possible to interpret legislation to give effect to human rights, the dialogue model requires the court to make a declaration of incompatibility and transmit it to the Attorney General. The legislation then requires the Attorney General to prepare a response and bring the declaration and the response before the legislature within a fixed period. This machinery creates a mechanism for a dialogue between the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature, in which the courts inform the executive of human rights deficiencies in the jurisdiction's legislation, and enables first the executive and then the legislature to consider what, if any, justification supports the legislative intrusion into human rights. Hence, one of the purposes of the model of this model of human rights legislation is to promote a human rights culture. The Australian Capital Territory was the first Australian jurisdiction to enact a dialogue model when it enacted the Human Rights Act in 2004. 2 years later, Victoria enacted the Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, and subsequently, after public consultation concerning the need for and the form of a Charter of Rights, New Matilda, a private organisation, has drafted a human rights bill, which I will call the New Matilda Bill, which is now in the public domain. Unlike the ACT and Victorian models, the New Matilda Bill is concerned with federal laws. And for that reason, my discussion concerning some of the potential constitutional difficulties arising from the dialogue model will concentrate on that bill. Section 4 of the new Matilda Bill enacts, and I quote, "The human rights in this Act are exercisable by everyone within Australia's jurisdiction." Part 3 specifies the human rights and freedoms that are exercisable in accordance with the Act. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which Australia ratified in 1980, and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which Australia ratified in 1975, are the source of the human rights which the new Matilda Bill seeks to enact into the Australian federal system. Sections 11 to 36 of that bill describe the civil and political rights that are exercisable, and they are all the rights, or basically all the rights that are found in those covenants. They are fundamental rights, and Section 4 declares that they are exercisable by everyone in Australia's jurisdiction. So it's not limited to citizens, it's everyone. Sections 37 to 43 describe the economic and social rights that are exercisable in Australia. They include the right to education, the right to work, the right to an adequate standard of living, the right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, and the right to social security. However, Section 42 limits those economic and social rights by declaring that they are subject to progressive realisation, and that their realisation may be limited by the financial resources available to government. As a result, when they're in dispute, the courts are directed to take account of various matters. However, even the civil and political rights to which Section 4 refers are not absolute. Section 10 of the bill declares, "This Act guarantees the rights and freedoms set down in it, subject only to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society." And a subsection of Section 10 sets out various matters that have been taken into account. Now, there's a considerable body of decisions on the Canadian equivalent of Section 10, which is found in Section 1 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The most recent authoritative decision of the Supreme Court of Canada on that provision was given 2 years ago in a case called Hislop, where 6 members of the Supreme Court of Canada said that the framework, said under Section 1, the government has the burden to demonstrate that a discriminatory provision is a reasonable limit on charter rights. If it meets this burden, the law will be saved as being a demonstrably justified, reasonable limit on that right. But the court then went on to formulate, or reformulate would probably be a better description, of the tests in determining it. And they are important tests. They are a four-pronged test. The tests are these. First, is the objective of the legislation pressing and substantial? Secondly, is there a rational connection between the government's legislation and its objective? Third, does the government's legislation minimally impair the charter right or freedom at stake? Four, is the deleterious effect of the charter breach outweighed by the salutary effect of the legislation? Thus, the effect of Section 10 of the Matilda Bill is that rights to which section refer must give way to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. Section 10, in effect, introduces a proportionality test which balances the rational needs of society against the human rights of individuals. The four-prong test formulated in Hislop is objective and similar to tests that that courts in this country, particularly the High Court, already use in the constitutional area. As Pamela Tait, the Solicitor General for Victoria, has said of a proportionality test in this area, this approach exposes the Benthamite flaw of considering human rights as absolute and inalienable and substitutes in its place a reasoned and logical approach to the justification of interferences with human rights. Whatever model of human rights is adopted in this country, adoption of the Section 10 limitation, in my view, is essential. Together with the objective four-prong test laid down by the Supreme Court of Canada, it provides a compelling answer to those opponents of human rights legislation who believe that giving courts the power to determine whether legislation interferes with human rights will make an unelected judiciary the governors of Australia. Now, however, although Section 4 says that the human rights in this Act are exercisable by everyone, it does not expressly say that it is creating rights. And when the bill is read as a whole, the better view is that apart from Section 54, which gives a right of action against a public authority, the new Matilda Bill does not create rights or causes of action. Instead, with the exception of federal laws that are incompatible with the rights specified in the bill, it provides immunity from the operation of laws, including the common law, that are inconsistent with those rights. Now, if this is the correct construction of Section 4 read in the context of the bill, it would invalidate the effect of any state or territory law that was inconsistent with those rights. Whether that was intended may be doubted. But however that may be, the immunity in respect of federal laws is more limited. In the context of federal legislation, effect will only be given to the Section 4 rights insofar as it is possible to interpret federal legislation consistently with those rights. Section 49 is a key provision in the Matilda Bill. It says, so far as it is possible to do, primary and subordinate legislation must be read and given effect in a way which is compatible with human rights. And Section 51 of the Bill says that if the court is satisfied that a provision of primary legislation is incompatible with a right or freedom set down in the Act, it may make a declaration of incompatibility. It goes on to provide, and this is one of the weaknesses of the of the proposed bill, as it is, in my view, a weakness of the Victorian and ACT bills, that a declaration does not affect the validity, continuing operation or enforcement of the provision in respect of which it's given and is not binding on the parties to the proceedings in which it is made. The section then goes on to require the court to transmit a copy of the declaration to the Attorney General, and it then imposes responsibilities on the Attorney General. Within 15 days of receiving the declaration, he must file it with the legislature, and he must prepare a written response to the declaration of incompatibility, indicating what action, if any, is proposed in relation to it, and the reasons for that action or non-action, and he's got to present it to the House of Representatives within 6 months after a copy of the declaration was first presented to the House. The result is that insofar as federal legislation applying to a controversy can be interpreted consistently with the human rights specified in Part 3 of the new Matilda Bill, the rights of the parties to that controversy must be determined in whole or in part by reference to that human right if it's relevant to the controversy. However, as I've explained, with the exception of Section 54, which gives the right of action against a public authority, The new Matilda Bill creates immunities, not rights or causes of actions. And that means that with the exception of that right of action under Section 54, the plaintiff's cause of action must exist at common law or arise from a statute independently of the bill. Many persons, including myself, think that is a great weakness in the new Matilda model, as it is in the ACT legislation and the Victorian Charter. However, the effect of Section 4 of the bill is to prevent any legislation, apart from incompatible federal legislation, modifying the human rights referred to in the bill, insofar as they are relevant to a cause of action or defence, and at least that's a step forward on the present legal situation. The United Kingdom has a interpretive provision which in substance, with a few verbal alterations, but in substance is the same as the new Matilda Bill. And English law lords have spoken approvingly of this, of the interpretive and dialogue provisions in the United Kingdom legislation. Lord Steyne has described the English Human Rights Act as carefully and subtly drafted, and Lord Roger has described it as beautifully drafted. But what may be praised as carefully and beautifully drafted in the United Kingdom may sow the seeds for constitutional destruction of similar legislation in Australia. Under the external affairs power conferred by the Constitution, the Federal Parliament has power to enact legislation that gives effect to human rights conventions and treaties, such as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And as I mentioned, those covenants are the source of the rights referred to in the Matilda Bill. However, unlike the United Kingdom, Australia has a written constitutional separation of legislative, executive, and judicial power to which all federal legislation must conform. Sections 1, 61, and 71 of the Constitution are the source of the long-accepted view that our federal constitution incorporates the political doctrine of the separation of powers. As a result of, as Justice Dixon once said, the Parliament is restrained both from reposing any power essentially judicial in any other organ or body, and from reposing any other than judicial power in such tribunals. So the question arises whether the provisions in Section 51 and 52 of the Matilda Bill, creating a dialogue between the courts and the Parliament, are invalid in that they invest a court exercising federal jurisdiction with non-judicial power. And closely allied to this question is whether the issues which would arise under the Sections 51 and 52 of that bill would involve matters within the meaning of Sections 75, 76 and 77 of the Constitution. Those three sections empower the Parliament to give jurisdiction to the federal courts and to state courts invested with federal jurisdiction. Federal judicial power can only be exercised in respect of matters. And unless the claim involved in a legal proceeding constitutes a matter, as that term has been defined by the High Court, the Parliament cannot give courts federal jurisdiction. Now, any human rights legislation that's inconsistent with the separation of powers doctrine will be invalid to the extent of that inconsistency. Although there can hardly be any doubt of the power of the Federal Parliament to give legislative effect to the rights enshrined in the International Covenants, powerful arguments support the conclusion that the Federal Parliament cannot constitutionally give effect to those rights by enacting enacting the dialogue provisions of human rights legislation that is embodied in the new Matilda Bill. Even those who argue that the Federal Court can constitutionally enact legislation in the form of the dialogue provision acknowledge the force of the contrary arguments. I'm afraid I'm more pessimistic about the prospects of a dialogue model being upheld by the High Court than those who believe that it would be constitutional if enacted at the federal level. It wouldn't surprise me if the High Court upheld the validity of the legislation. There are some persuasive arguments in favour of constitutionality. Conversely, it wouldn't surprise me if the High Court held that so much of the dialogue model has required a federal court to make declarations of incompatibility and communicate them to the Attorney General was valid. Although it will be a close-run thing, as the Duke of Wellington might have said, I think that the better view is that the High Court will hold that the incompatibility provisions are invalid unless the High Court can be persuaded to adopt a more radical and functional approach to what is judicial power and what is a matter for the purpose of the Constitution than it has done in the past. Now, the arguments concerning the constitutional validity of sections 51 and 52 that set up the dialogue procedures of the new Matilda Bill are lengthy, technical, complex and difficult, and their exposition would be out of place in a discussion such as this. I have set out the arguments for and against the constitutional validity of the dialogue model of human rights protection in an appendix to the paper, which can be read when this paper to which I am speaking is published. Unfortunately, although there are arguments for and against, as I have said, I fear that the arguments in support of the bill will fail to persuade the High Court that the compatibility provisions are valid. However, that's not the only constitutional problem that may arise in terms of the new Matilda Bill. Constitutional imperatives arising from the doctrine of separation powers also limit the scope of courts exercising federal jurisdiction under the dialogue model to interpret legislation in a way that gives the fullest scope to human rights. I will discuss some of these imperatives and their consequences for the dialogue model in discussing that direction in the new Matilda Bill that I referred to, namely that courts should interpret legislation so far as it is possible to do in a way that is compatible with human rights. I will conclude this discussion about the dialogue model by contending that it is fraught with constitutional difficulties in the federal sphere and that the campaign to enact a dialogue model should be abandoned. Instead, the Parliament should follow the 1960 Canadian model of a legislative bill of rights and use it to give legal effect to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and, if thought necessary, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights by legislation that empowers courts invested with federal jurisdiction to hold that state and territory legislation that is inconsistent with the human rights legislation is invalid, and that federal legislation is to be read subject to the Bill of Rights that gives effect to these international covenants. If the Parliament wants to say, the Commonwealth wants to say, this particular piece of legislation is not subject to the Bill of Rights, then it should expressly say so. But speaking generally, all federal legislation should be interpreted subject to the Bill of Rights. The provisions of the model, the Matilda Bill, or similar dialogue models that will have the greatest effect on the work of the courts are sections 3, 10, 48, 49 and 50 of the bill. I've read section 49, that the court is, so far as possible, to give primary and subordinate legislation an interpretation which is compatible with human rights. Section 48 in the Matilda model is an important provision in the day-to-day workings of the court, because it declares that international law and the judgments of foreign and international courts and tribunals are relevant, if relevant to a human right, may be considered in interpreting that human right. Accordingly, the great body of decisions of the Human Rights Committee of the United Nations, the European Court of Human Rights, and the Supreme Court of Canada will be relevant material for the consideration of the Australian courts. Obviously, a key provision in the proposed legislation is Section 59, with its direction about interpreting compatibly with human rights. This section is identical in substance with Section 3 of the United Kingdom Act. It differs, however, from Section 32 of the Victorian Charter and Section 30 of the ACT legislation, both of which require statutory provisions to be interpreted in a way that is compatible with human rights, and this is the important limitations, but also consistently with the purpose of the legislation. As a result, the new Matilda Bill, like its United Kingdom counterpart, give the courts a far more radical power of interpretation than is found in the Victorian and ACT legislation. And as I will later show, this is a matter of considerable constitutional significance. Now, it's a settled principle of the interpretation of statutes in Australia that they are to be interpreted and applied so far as the language permits, so as not to derogate from fundamental rights and freedoms. It's also a settled principle of the interpretation of statutes in Australia that, so far as their language permits, statutes are to be interpreted in conformity with international law. However, the direction concerning interpretation in Section 49 of the new Matilda Bill goes beyond these common law principles of statutory interpretation. It will apply to a number of rights that under the common law are not regarded as fundamental for the purposes of those principles of statutory interpretation, particularly economic and social rights. But more importantly, it declares that so far as it is possible to do so, legislation must be read in a way that is compatible with human rights. As cases in the United Kingdom show, the courts have read this direction as empowering them to redraft legislation so as to give it an interpretation that is contrary to the intention of Parliament. Lord Steyne has said that this is the intention of Parliament expressed in Section 3, and the courts must give effect to this intention. This far-reaching principle of statutory interpretation has resulted from the word possible in Section 3 of the United Kingdom Act when it's read in the context of the Act, and of course the word possible is in Section 49 of the new Matilda Bill. Now, in a case called Gaydon, in a long but significant passage concerning the interpretation of that section, Lord Nicholls said, The interpretive obligation decreed by Section 3 is of an unusual and far-reaching character. Section 3 may require a court to depart from the unambiguous meaning of the legislation which it would otherwise bear. In the ordinary course, the interpretation of legislation involves seeking the intention reasonably to be attributed to Parliament. Section 3 may require the court to depart from this legislation, that is, depart from the intention of Parliament which enacted the legislation. The question of difficulty is how far and in what circumstances Section 3 requires a court to depart from the intention of enacting Parliament. And there is no doubt that the cases and the reasons for decision have gone a long way in such an interpretation. A number of propositions can be found in the English case law, and they are these. One, Courts have power to modify legislation to give effect to human rights. Two, courts can modify legislation whose meaning is unambiguous. Three, courts can modify legislation even though the modification is contrary to the intention of Parliament. Four, courts can modify legislation that is enacted after the enactment of the Human Rights Act 1998. Now, I might briefly refer to decisions of the House of Lords, which is the leading judicial authority in the United Kingdom, showing how the courts have acted in certain cases. In the Gaydan's case, to which I referred when I quoted from Lord Nicholls, in that case, the Rent Act gave a person who is living with the original tenant, has a wife or husband, certain rights. The plain meaning of the relevant provision was contrary to the human rights of a homosexual person, in that it permitted the survivor of a heterosexual, but not a homosexual couple, to become a statutory tenant by succession. Despite the plain language of the statutory provision, the House of Lords applied Section 3, the interpretive provision, and interpreted the Rent Act to give the same rights to the surviving partner of a same-sex couple. Now, three other decisions show the far-reaching effect of the House of Lords' interpretation of Section 3 of the United Kingdom Act, which, as I say, is identical in substance with Section 49 of the New Matilda Bill. In the Queen Against A, number 2, the House of Lords had to interpret a rape shield provision that limited the circumstances in which a complainant could be questioned about his or her sexual past. However, the House of Lords read down the provision to ensure a fair trial as required by Article 6 of the European Convention on Human Rights. The House held that a court could not reject questioning or evidence about a person's past, as required by the Rape Shield provision, if that questioning or evidence concerned logically relevant sexual experiences between the complainant and the accused. Thus, the interpretive provision in Section 3 had the effect of amending the Rape Shield provision that Parliament had enacted for the purpose of protecting witnesses. Moreover, in that case, the Rape Shield legislation had been enacted after the Human Rights Act. Then in Sheldrake's case, the House of Lords found that a provision which, if, in their words, conventionally interpreted, would have imposed a legal burden on an accused, was inconsistent with the presumption of innocence guaranteed by Article 6 of the European Convention. So the House interpreted the legal burden to simply mean an evidentiary burden, which was despite an express acknowledgement that this was not what Parliament had intended when it enacted the legislation. Then finally, in Secretary of State against MB, the House of Lords had to interpret a provision in the Prevention of Terrorism Act. The provision required a court to refuse a person subject to a control order access to material if it was contrary to the public interest. Nevertheless, Baroness Hale said that the provision should be read and given effect unless to do so would be incompatible with the right of that of the accused person to a fair trial. Again, an amendment of the legislative intention. Now, these decisions and the reasoning in them support a number of propositions in respect of the interpretive provision expressed in the terms of Section 3, and I've referred to those. Now, given the manner in which the House of Lords has interpreted Section 3 of the United Kingdom Act, it's not surprising that according to a talk given by Mr. Murray Hunt to this commission in February this year, the 10 years of operation of the United Kingdom Act has produced 26 declarations of incompatibility, and 7 of them were overturned on appeal. That is to say, on only 17 occasions have the courts been unable to interpret legislation in a way which is compatible with the convention rights. And that's a remarkable statistic. It indicates that either the great bulk of English legislation enacted in the past or since 1998 has been compatible with human rights, or the United Kingdom courts have exercised substantial legislative power to bring United Kingdom legislation into line with the European Convention on Human Rights. And of those two alternatives, the latter seems the most likely one. That is, this achievement of only 17 declarations of incompatibility in 17 years has been achieved by judicial amendment of parliamentary legislation. Remarkably, on all 17 occasions where declarations have been issued, the Parliament has later amended the legislation in question to make it compatible with the Convention. Proponents of the dialogue naturally point to these results to prove that the dialogue model promotes a human rights culture and has not diminished the relationship between the judiciary and the legislature and the executive branches of government. But although Section 49 of the new Matilda Bill reproduces the substantial effect of Section 3 of the English Human Rights Act, I think there is little, if any, chance that the High Court of Australia would hold that Section 49, as interpreted by the House of Lords, was a valid act of the Federal Parliament. As I have indicated, our Federal Constitution gives effect to the political doctrine of the separation of powers. Not only does the Constitution prohibit the legislature and the executive being given judicial power, but the Constitution also prohibits the judiciary being given legislative power. In the words of the famous United States Chief Justice Marshall, in a case which was cited by Justice Isaacs, in a case in the High Court, the difference between the departments undoubtedly is that the legislature makes, the executive executes, and the judiciary construes the law. And Justice Isaacs went on to say that it would require very explicit and unmistakable words to undo the effect of the dominant principle of demarcation. In interpreting what are known as severance clauses, that is, clauses that declare that where an enactment is construed as being in excess of power, it shall nevertheless be a valid enactment to the extent to which it is not in excess of that power, the High Court has frequently said that if the court holds parts of legislation invalid, a severance clause enacted by the Parliament cannot constitutionally require the court to redraft or save the valid parts of the legislation if that would involve the court in a legislative exercise. The Parliament cannot use the court as a delegate to produce a new law from the valid parts of the old, if to do so would give the new law a new scope and object or a new meaning, producing a new operation of a kind uncontemplated by the legislature. In the what is known as the Concrete Pipes case, Justice Menzies said, "It is for Parliament to make laws, and the court's only authority is to interpret and apply them. Parliament cannot direct courts to reconstruct out of the ruins of one invalid law of general application a number of valid laws of particular application." And in the Native Title Act case, the High Court accepted that constitutional problem. Six members of the court, including myself, said that an attempt to enact a particular section in the Native Title Act case failed, either because the Parliament cannot exercise the power of courts or because the courts cannot exercise the powers of Parliament. It follows that if Section 49 were interpreted in the same manner that the United Kingdom courts have interpreted Section 3 of the Human Rights Act, it would be invalid. I think it's highly unlikely that the High Court would countenance an interpretation of Section 49 that would authorise courts exercising federal jurisdictions to amend federal acts of Parliament. Accordingly, the overwhelming probability is that the High Court would give Section 49 a more modest interpretation than its United Kingdom counterpart. It seems probable that to keep Section 49 consistent with the doctrine of separation of powers, the High Court would give Section 49 a meaning that was little different from the wording of Section 32 of the Victorian Charter or Section 30 of the ACT Act. That is, it would hold that on its proper construction, Section 49 required legislation to be interpreted in a way that is compatible with human rights only when such interpretation was consistent with the purpose of the legislation. And the court could do this quite easily by interpreting the words so far as possible to do so as being limited to an interpretation that was not inconsistent with the purpose of the legislation. However, to depart from the extended construction that the House of Lords gave to Section 3 doesn't mean that Section 49 of the Matilda Bill would do little more than express in statutory form the common law principle of interpretation that courts should not, that statutes should not be read as intending to diminish fundamental rights. Legislative provisions are frequently ambiguous and capable of several interpretations, and an interpretation that is compatible with human rights will often be consistent with the purpose of the legislation. And the New Zealand decision serves as a very good illustration. Under the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, a person had a right of freedom of expression. The accused was charged under a statute that made it an offence to damage the New Zealand flag in any manner with the intention of dishonouring it. And as a symbol of the accused's opposition to the government, or the policies of the government, he turned the flag upside down and burnt it. And he was convicted of an offence at first instance. The district court that convicted him interpreted the word dishonouring as simply meaning disrespecting, and since he had an intention to disrespect the flag, that was sufficient. But on appeal, the court sought to identify a meaning of dishonour which constituted the least possible limitation on the right or freedom in question, and it accepted the accused's submission that when read consistently with the right to freedom of expression, the proper meaning of dishonour was vilify or defile the flag, neither of which the appellant or the accused had the intention of doing, and he was therefore acquitted. However, when the purpose of Parliament is clear and the purpose of a statutory provision seems incompatible with the human rights in question, the court will have no option under the dialogue model except to make a declaration of incompatibility, assuming such a declaration passes the constitutional test of validity. There must be doubt, for example, whether Mr. Al-Khateeb would have fared better in the High Court if the new Matilda Bill had been in force as a federal enactment. His application for refugee status had been denied by the Commonwealth. Under Section 196 and 198 of the Migration Act, he had to be apprehended and then detained in custody until either he obtained a visa or he was deported. Unfortunately, no country would agree to receive him if he was deported from Australia, and by a 4-3 majority, the High Court held that despite the fact that he could not be deported and the minister would not grant him a visa, the terms of the Migration Act required his continued detention. The minority justices held that he could not be detained as long as he could not be deported. Now, the majority justices, of which I was one, and which I've been much criticised for, but I'll have to bear that with as much fortitude as I can gather, took the view that the plain purpose of the legislation was that an unlawful entrant into Australia, which Mr. Al-Khateb was, had to be detained in immigration intention until that person was either given a visa or deported. At least so far as I was concerned, to introduce issues of suspension of detention was not an application of the fundamental principle of construction to which Chief Justice Gleeson, who was one of the dissenters, referred to, but it was an amendment of the imperative terms of the sections of the Migration Act. In applying the fundamental principle of construction, one usually reads the legislation as not intended to impair a fundamental right. But in reality, that was not what the minority justices did. Logically, they had to accept, as I think they did, that Mr. Al-Khateb's initial apprehension and detention was lawful. However, in effect, they said, once it appeared that no country would accept him, he had to be released and could not be apprehended while that state of affairs existed. I'm afraid that much as I deplored the result, I thought that that constituted an amendment of the Migration Act, not a giving effect to the fundamental principle of statutory construction about not interfering with fundamental rights. I couldn't accept that the Migration Act could be construed as also providing for the release of Mr. Al-Khateb subject to conditions or otherwise, while no other country would receive him, when the legislation expressly said that he had to be detained until he was given a visa or removed from Australia. Now, the circumstances of Mr. Al-Khateb's case were tragic, and in my judgment, I lamented that Australia did not have a Bill of Rights that could have overcome the mandatory terms of sections 196 and 198 of the legislation. But the question is, would he have been better before the High Court under a Bill of Rights framed as the new Matilda Bill is, that is, using the dialogue model? I think that there must be serious doubts about the answer to that question. The majority justices may well have held, if that bill had been in operation, that to give effect to his right to liberty and freedom from arbitrary detention under that bill was inconsistent with the purpose of the Migration Act, which was to detain a person such as Mr. Al-Khateb in custody until he was removed from the country or given a visa. On the other hand, I've little doubt if he had been detained under similar circumstances in the United Kingdom, a court would have held that he was entitled to be released from detention until some country gave him asylum. And if we had a Bill of Rights, the same result would have occurred. And if we had the Bill of Rights, which I would venture to the legislative Bill of Rights, which I suggest we should have, he would also be released. Now, the case of Al-Khateb shows a weakness in the dialogue model of human rights protection. If a person's human rights under that model can't prevail, if they would conflict with the purpose of the legislation, those rights must go unprotected. And that may possibly occur in many situations. On any view, the interpretive provisions of the dialogue model are suboptimal. I think the better course is to reject the dialogue model as a vehicle for implementing the interpretation of human rights in the federal sphere, and for that matter, at the state level. It has a number of significant weaknesses in terms of promoting and protecting human rights. First, at the very least, there is a grave doubt as to the constitutionality of the Declaration of Incompatibility provisions, which are at the heart of the dialogue model. Second, even if those provisions are upheld by reason of the Parliament's inability to confer legislative power on courts exercising federal jurisdiction, an interpretive provision such as Section 49 may often fail to protect the human rights that are exercisable under the Act. Third, if Section 4 means what it says, and the human rights in this Act are exercisable by everyone within Australia's jurisdiction. The new Matilda Bill will affect the interpretation of state legislation, because by reason of Section 109 of the Constitution, the state laws would be inoperative to the extent that they were inconsistent with the federal Section 4. Yet there is no dialogue between the federal courts and the state legislatures, nor constitutionally could there be. Fourth, if the human rights referred to in Section 4 only engage with federal laws and not state laws, there will be a very large gap in the protection of human rights in Australia unless and until states and territories adopt similar legislation. Fifth, apart from the right of action against public authorities, the dialogue model creates no rights or causes of action. Sixth, as a result, those whose human rights have been infringed have no remedies for the infringement of those rights. They can't obtain damages or injunctions to restrain conduct that infringes their rights. Now, this is a breach of Article 2, subparagraph 3 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which provides that if a person's rights under that covenant have been violated, the person has a right to an effective remedy. Under that article, each state party, and Australia is one, undertakes to ensure that any person whose right or freedom is violated shall have an effective remedy, and that the person claiming such a remedy shall have his or her right determined by a competent judicial, administrative or legislative authorities, or by another competent authority provided by the legal system of the state. And I might interpolate to say that the Human Rights Committee has been critical of these dialogue models. They do not think they give adequate protection. Seventh, even if the Parliament amends its legislation after receiving a declaration of incompatibility, considerable time will usually elapse before anything is done. Even where the amendment is made, it may be of no benefit to the person whose rights have been infringed. Eighth, because courts exercising federal jurisdiction cannot be given legislative type powers that the courts of the United Kingdom have been using, it seems a near certainty that declarations of incompatibility will be made more frequently in Australia than in the United Kingdom. This may have serious consequences for the workload of the Parliament. Although the Attorney General's response must be presented to the House of Representatives not later than 6 months after the day a copy of the declaration is presented to that House, there is no time limit imposed for the Parliament to take action in respect of that response. And if there is, or if there are a large number of declarations of incompatibility coming forward, then there may well be a logjam. May I say with great respect that what may have been overlooked by those who champion the enactment of a dialogue model of human rights for Australia is that what may work effectively in a jurisdiction with an unwritten constitution and a single legislature, as in the United Kingdom or New Zealand, may not work as effectively in a federal jurisdiction with a written constitution that incorporates the political doctrine of the separation of powers. So, instead of the dialogue model, the Parliament should give effect to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and if thought necessary, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights by legislation that empowers courts invested with federal jurisdiction to hold that legislation that is inconsistent with the human rights legislation is invalid in the case of state and territory legislation, and in the absence of an express statement to the contrary, all federal legislation is to be subject to the human rights legislation of the Parliament. The result would be that private citizens would have judicially enforceable rights that were not affected by state, territory or federal legislation inconsistent with those rights, and would have immediate judicial remedies for breaches of those rights. In the absence of a notwithstanding clause in the federal legislation, their rights would not be dependent upon whether their right was consistent with the purpose of the legislation, but would be judged and applied on its merits and by reference to the federal equivalent of Section 10 of the new Matilda Act, which is the reasonable limitation provision. Now, a human rights legislative model on the lines I have suggested would have only a minimal effect on parliamentary sovereignty. Under my preferred model, it would be open to the Parliament of the Commonwealth to insert in any federal legislation a notwithstanding clause which required the courts to give effect to that particular legislation, notwithstanding the enactment of the Bill of Rights legislation. And of course, it would be open to the Parliament after any decision was given by a court with which the Parliament disagreed to insert a notwithstanding clause in the legislation. Finally, such a model would be well within federal power and would not be open to the constitutional attacks that undoubtedly await the dialogue model. Now, I'm conscious that my criticisms of the dialogue model will provide ammunition for those who are opposed to the enactment of any form of bills of right, statutory or constitutional, and I regret that that is so. But it would be a tragedy for the human rights movement in Australia if the dialogue model was enacted and the declaration of incompatibility provision was struck down as unconstitutional. In that event, there would be no dialogue between the judiciary and the legislature and the executive, and apart from the admittedly important right of action against federal public authorities, the human rights of the people of the Commonwealth would have only marginally more protection than they presently do under the common law principles of statutory construction. Moreover, as I have pointed out, the dialogue model has other deficiencies, not the least of which is the lack of judicially enforceable remedies except as against public authorities of the Commonwealth. Thank you very much.